Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. 39 years ago on NBC's Today Show, Tom Brokaw introduced a young New York real estate developer to the nation. His name was Donald Trump, and in the milquetoast media landscape of 1980, Trump kept with the times with an attempt at humility.
Mr. Trump, what's left in your life? You're 33 years old. You're worth all this money. You say you didn't say that you want to be worth $1 billion.
No, I really don't. I just want to keep busy and keep active and be interested in what I do, and that's all there is to life as far as I'm concerned. I really am not looking to make tremendous amounts of money. I'm looking to enjoy my life, and if that happens to go with it, that's fabulous.
It is, of course, a long way from that to the White House, including stops along the way that give narcissism a bad name.
My people are so smart. And you know what else they say about my people? The polls. They say, I have the most loyal people. Did you ever see that? Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay? It's like incredible.
My guest today explains that journey in a new book that defines our 45th president as television in human form. His name is James Poniewozik. I may or may not pronounce that correctly today, and he is the TV critic at the New York Times. The book is Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. James Poniewozik, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So do I have the name correct?
It's Poniewozik. It's Poniewozik. I think you were pretty darn close. Yeah.
Okay. Poniewozik. Okay. So you begin your book with an anecdote about Rona Barrett, who was a famous TV gossip reporter back in the 70s and the 80s. And in 1980, she had just gone to NBC from ABC, and she decided to put together an interview special focusing on the super rich. Donald Trump was one of her guests, and as you point out, Rona Barrett asked a question that looks downright brilliant in hindsight, which was?
For some people, the ultimate goal in life has been becoming the President of the United States. Would you like to be the President of the United States?
I really don't believe I would, Rona, but I would like to see somebody as the President who could do the job, and there are very capable people in this country.
Why wouldn't you dedicate yourself to public service?
Because I think it's a very mean life. I would love and I would dedicate my life to this country, but I see it as being a mean life. And I also see it as somebody with strong views and somebody with the kind of views that are maybe a little bit unpopular, which may be right, but maybe unpopular, wouldn't necessarily have a chance of getting elected against somebody with no great brain but a big smile.
So tell me a little bit about when you first came across this and what you made of it when you first watched that.
That was a clip from Rona Barrett's interview with Trump, which actually didn't make the cut in the eventual special that she did for NBC, but it resurfaced during the 2016 campaign. And one thing that particularly struck me about it is that it goes on from there to talk about how the reason for this dynamic that the young Trump cites there is television. That television has very much changed the process so that it favors sort of innocuous, smiling, pleasing, sort of sunny figures. I think the way he put it in the interview was it favors somebody with a big smile over necessarily ideas or thoughts that might be controversial and so forth. It's basically a critique of the media and the effect that it's had on the political process. Obviously, the irony there is that 36 years later, Donald Trump is going to get elected president largely, arguably nearly entirely because of television, not simply because of, you know, how the amount of television attention that he was able to gather in his campaign, but the fact that he basically made himself out of television. He was somebody who constructed a media persona, you know, going back to the 80s as a businessman who understood that appearances on television were a powerful form of currency in our society, and who was elected as very much a controversial figure who, incited people and raised controversies on television, very much the opposite of the way he described it in 1980. And the thing about it was he was right at both times. You know, a figure like the Donald Trump of today could not have gotten elected in the media sphere of 1980. And our current polarized media environment very much made the election of somebody like him possible. And so the two stories that I'm trying to tell in the book are number one, the story of Donald Trump, the television character essentially, and how he shaped himself in the media over those decades as a public figure, but also how the medium of television changed from the mass media of the 1980s to the niche media of today, and how that affects the kind of public discourse that you have on it.
Yeah, and that narrative arc, you go through, you start in obviously the early 80s, and I think you used the, was it an industry term, LOP, least offensive programming?
The least objectionable program, yes.
I'm sorry, least objectionable programming. And that was kind of the mantra because it was such a mass medium. You had three channels, give or take, in most places. And then you carry us not only through Trump's story, but the story of anti-heroes and The Sopranos and how media changed and television in particular changed. It became, much less vanilla, so to speak. And what I wanted to ask you about that journey is whether Trump evolved and changed with those media shifts, or did the media just move more toward him?
I think that the media, I mean, it's a little bit of both, you know, as these things often are. I think the media became more conducive to, you know, a kind of brash, controversial figure becoming popular. A show like The Apprentice, where Donald Trump sat in an office and fired somebody every week, wouldn't have aired, you know, on the NBC of the 1960s or 1970s. But once television had entered an era where, you know, partly through the rise of cable, provocative reality TV became popular and then became more of a mass phenomenon, that sort of thing became possible. So on the one hand, I think that the media environment changed in a way in which a figure like Donald Trump, it was more hospitable to him. But I also think that Donald Trump, who has always been sort of a celebrity-seeking missile, you know, who cultivated a profile in the tabloids and in talk shows before he had really done much of anything as a businessman back in the early 80s, he really kind of, I think, instinctually molded himself to the media of, you know, whatever time he was living in, and presented a persona that would draw attention to him and attract celebrity to himself. So, you know, I think there is an element, too, of him adapting himself to the media of his time.
That's the voice of James Poniewozik. He is the author of Audience of One, and he is the television critic at The New York Times. You referenced Donald Trump as a television character, and you write in the book, you write, quote, "Donald Trump is the most influential character in the history of TV. He deserves a careful review," end quote. So we're talking about someone who has been on television for 40 years, and between The Apprentice, Fox and Friends, the campaigns, and now the presidency, almost nonstop since 2004. How did you sift through all of that material?
Some of this is material that I'd seen before. I watched a lot of The Apprentice when it aired, you know, certainly as a TV critic and a TV viewer. But, you know, it was a lot of digging in the archives. The internet certainly made researching this book possible. When I was doing the research for the book, you know, funny enough, The Apprentice only recently became available in a legal streaming form. I did sort of scour YouTube and the dark corners of the internet for pirated copies of The Apprentice to go back and get a kind of complete videography of Trump's appearances on that. Likewise, the Internet TV Archive, for instance, is very useful for going back and watching all of Trump's appearances on Fox, and in particular Fox and Friends, which was eye-opening to me, even as a TV critic who follows this sort of thing. I wasn't really aware until I went back and watched the extent to which Trump had a parallel presence as a conservative media commentator, on Fox at the same time that he had a career on NBC on The Apprentice and The Celebrity Apprentice.
Yeah, I hadn't actually thought about that, because he started on Fox and Friends around 2011, and The Apprentice runs it through, what, 2014?
2015, The Apprentice with
2015,
Trump.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
And then there was the one season with Arnold Schwarzenegger in 2017. The Apprentice obviously established Donald Trump as a primetime celebrity, and it built on a character that he had been building in the media since the 80s, which is Donald Trump, flashy, decisive businessman, larger than life, is surrounded by these fabulous symbols of wealth, has a helicopter with his name on the side of it. I say that Donald Trump was, in a way, reality TV before reality TV existed. in other words, he surrounded himself with a lot of symbology and images that people associate with wealth that creates a brand. And that was a brand that was very easy for Mark Burnett, creating The Apprentice, to borrow and license in the form of a reality TV show, which, needs to communicate in broad strokes. A show like The Apprentice needs somebody who is sort of the image of a businessman more than it necessarily needs an actual successful businessman. So he was great to play the part for that. He becomes a figure on Fox News, as you say, after The Apprentice has been on for a while, and he enters the Foxosphere, interestingly, through Fox and Friends, which is Fox's morning news/entertainment program, right? It sort of exists at the cusp of celebrity and entertainment and politics, which was exactly where Donald Trump existed. And it was the perfect environment to port that character over from the world of primetime entertainment into the world of politics, where you can take a lot of these same sort of elements of the persona that Donald Trump had established in The Apprentice, tough talking, controversial, etc., and apply them to politics.
I'm curious, as we come up upon our first break, I just want to ask you real quickly, from a personal standpoint, at a time when a lot of people are a little bit exhausted with all of the drama, the Twitter, everything on TV, how energy sapping was it to go through this much programming of anyone, in large doses?
It's pretty draining. I sometimes tell people that, being a TV critic is kind of like being, the guy at Chernobyl who has to strap on the radiation suit and expose himself to a lot of stuff in order to get at the meltdowns at the center of our society. So, yeah.
So we need you on that wall is what we do. We need you on that wall, right?
Exactly.
Again, my guest is James Poniewozik. He is the chief television critic at the New York Times. He is also the author of the new book, Audience of One. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we're going to talk more about Donald Trump, television, and the politics of 2019. Stay with us here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins, and my guest today is James Poniewozik. He is the television critic at the New York Times, and he is the author of the new book, Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. When we went to the break, you were talking a little bit about the energy required to go through the television history of Donald Trump. One of the other things I was wondering about from your perspective is you're going back and watching these things, obviously, at a different time and with a much different lens because Donald Trump is now president and we know all the things that are to come. So how difficult was it to keep these past performances and shows and cameos in their contemporary context?
You know, I lived through a lot of this. So, you know, I covered The Apprentice when it was on the air. You know, I'm old enough to remember Donald Trump when he was a figure who, you know, made cameos on primetime sitcoms and so forth. So, you know, I think I had, you know, a fairly decent sense of the arc of Donald Trump's career. You know, in that sense, I think it wasn't too difficult. I think that, you know, an important thing when you're doing what is to me like basically a book of cultural history is to supplement that with, you know, reading and research on the culture and the politics and the history of the time. So that you are understand the context in which this figure is being received, you understand what's going on in his life. In other words, yeah. So you have to make a conscious effort to, you know, if you are watching Donald Trump as a pop cultural figure in the 1990s, you know, to keep in mind that you're watching the Trump of 1990s and not the Trump of, you know, 2019 transported into the 90s.
You mentioned some of his cameos, and it's interesting. So in the 80s, he is this playboy real estate developer. He's been in the tabloids. He starts to get national attention. He's on David Letterman a lot. And then you move on to the 90s, and his businesses yeah. are falling apart. He is struggling financially, but he benefits from what you said earlier, which is he is this cartoon character, this mascot, if you will, of what people think of as a rich guy. And so he becomes sort of the go-to placeholder. He's in Home Alone 2. He's on Suddenly Susan. He's on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, The Nanny, Drew Carey, Sex and the City. He's in a Pizza Hut ad. When I was reading this in your book, I mean, I had forgotten so much of that. So I'm just curious, how much of that was, as you say, he was just the easy shorthand, and how much of it was him trying to insert himself into pop culture?
I mean, he always wanted attention, and he sought it out. You know, it certainly a lot of this was his doing. You know, filmmakers have said that a lot of times the price of getting permission to film on a Trump property, for instance, was that you had to offer Mr. Trump a cameo, even though those sometimes would end up on the cutting room floor. So, you know, this was certainly something that he sought out. I mean, one of the earliest things that he said, that he's told biographers, was that, you know, as a very young man, before he went into his dad's real estate business, he had considered going to Hollywood and getting into the movie business. And he decided against doing that. He decided, I want to bring show business into real estate. And, you know, that meant in many ways operating like a celebrity, you know, always being conscious of one's brand, keeping oneself in the public eye. You know, and going back to his sort of Hollywood period in the 90s, to me, it's actually a fascinating and I think underappreciated period in his evolution, because when people talk about this period in Trump's life simply from the standpoint of his business, it's considered, you know, it's the low point, right? He hits the end of the 80s. His business is going to bankruptcies. He's overextended. He owes a lot of money to creditors and so on. And it's sort of, you know, viewed it at the period at which his business is bottomed out. But for exactly that reason, because he essentially needed to keep up his appearances to build up the brand, because they actually contributed a value to the brand of any Trump branded property or whatever. This became the time when this figure, this cartoon that he's played in popular culture, becomes more important than his actual business career. The public persona of Donald Trump has to bail out the actual Donald Trump, and that is very important to everything that came after, becoming this sort of symbol of business on The Apprentice, and then everything that evolved out of that, because this is the time when playing the character of Donald Trump becomes his main job.
Yeah, I was going to say, one of the points that you make in the book several times is that many analysts, historians, pundits have missed the point by thinking that Trump's story really starts with the business career. And what you're arguing, yeah, obviously, in this book is he is a media creation, media figure, and that is how he got to the White House. It wasn't the real estate or anything else he had done. It was this character that he plays on TV.
Yeah, I think that there is still a resistance to viewing Trump as the pop cultural figure that he is and has been. To Trump supporters, it feels like it's dismissive. No, he's a businessman. He's well known because he's a businessman, and that's it. To people who are Trump opponents, it seems like it's minimizing the significance of him as a political figure. And I think simply to people who cover politics, there's a tendency to kind of look down on this stuff. But I think that this figure who has been in the mythology of America's pop culture for four decades, which was why he was a household name and was able to turn that household name into a political career, I think one has to understand this to understand how we got to the point where this person could go directly from hosting a primetime show on NBC to running a successful campaign for president. People sometimes liken him to, Ronald Reagan, who was a movie actor and became president. But Ronald Reagan had to go through the processes of becoming an establishment Republican figure. He had to,
he was a governor and he was
governor of California for two terms. And, he was a figure in the Republican Party, and he ran for president in 1976 and lost. Donald Trump, went straight from the Apprentice boardroom to the White House using only the medium of television as a route to power. And that's just a major change of ours in our society, that you have to understand the medium of TV in order to really appreciate.
You say it much more artfully than I'm going to say it, but the statement in the book is something to the effect of, Ike had to go win D-Day. All Trump had to do was win the 9 o'clock hour on NBC.
Yeah. Eisenhower became president by winning the war in the European theater, and Donald Trump became president by winning the 9 p.m. time slot on NBC. It's very true.
And one of the things I wonder, right after Trump was elected, you started to hear people speculating about, well, could Oprah Winfrey beat Donald Trump, or this celebrity or that celebrity, in effect saying that he was the demarcation for having this media TV type figure go to the White House on a more frequent basis. And so I'm wondering, from your perspective, how true do you think that will be?
I think that it's absolutely true that, mastery of the media is a very powerful political tool now. And we've seen that somebody can become president simply through being a master of media without any, intermediate steps. But that's not as simple as saying that anybody who's good on TV can be elected president. Donald Trump hosted a reality show. That doesn't mean that, like, Jeff Probst is going to be president someday, right? Right. Like, your cultural persona that you've established, your appearance, your presentation also has to dovetail with a political message and with a political constituency. In this case, a lot of the aspects of Donald Trump's persona as a, you know, a celebrity businessman, as a host in reality TV, a lot of the ethos of reality TV, right? Life is a competition. And, you know, you need to, you know, you need to, you know, others need to fail so that you succeed. A lot of these things were, you know, able to map onto the language of politics as it is often discussed in, you know, in cable news. A lot of, you know, the notion, you know, it's better if we run the government like a business, is something that had been an existing thing in conservative politics for a while. And so he was able to apply that branding to that. So, you know, I think that if it is the right celebrity with the right message, yes, you definitely can do that. I think it's not outlandish that, you know, somebody like Oprah, who is a very different sort of public persona from Donald Trump, but one that, you know, might sort of mesh with the ethos of the Democratic Party more, you know, could conceivably run for president someday. The question with Oprah is, you know, would she want to? Because in many senses, I think Oprah would rather be Oprah than be president. But, you know, I could absolutely see a future where, you know, say a Fox News personality runs for president and makes a good run at it and wins. You know, I mean, Pat Buchanan attempted that in 1992 and at least gave George H.W. Bush a scare in the Republican primary. So, yeah, you know, I certainly think that, you know, I'm not saying we're only going to have TV star presidents from here on out, but it is definitely, you know, on the menu of ways to become president if you are the right star with, you know, a media presence that dovetails with a political constituency.
That is the voice of James Poniewozik. He is the author of the new book, Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. I'm curious, you also touch on this a little bit, which is the interesting dichotomy that Donald Trump is not only a TV creation and character in many ways, but he is an avid consumer of television, and yet he likes to deny that he watches that much television, although anyone who follows his Twitter feed, for example, could probably tell what he is watching. What do you think is the tension there? Why does he not want to be seen loving what he clearly loves?
You know, it is like the great shameful love that he can't entirely admit to, because, you know, he obviously he loved being on television. He clearly watches you know, a lot of it. He can't resist watching, you know, and monitoring coverage of himself. And, you know, when you're the president, cable news is a 24-hour show in which the president is always the star. I think, you know, without getting overly psychoanalytical about it, there is a certain sense that in him that watching TV is a passive act, you know, almost, you know, infantile in a way, that he doesn't, as somebody who, you know, presents himself as a strong man of action, decisive businessman, busy, you know, doesn't want to confess to doing too much of. So you will get Donald Trump, you know, complaining about his coverage on CNN while at the same time tweeting, "I never watch it, by the way." it's the love of his life that he can never entirely confess to.
And you have anecdote after anecdote in this book of cabinet members, people on his staff, members of Congress. Anyone who wants to speak to him once he is in the White House, even if they have personal access to him, the best way to get through to him is to go on television and do it.
Yeah, I mean, and that's where the title Audience of One came from.
Right.
You know, that once this, you know, figure who is so much of TV and who is so consumed by TV becomes president, necessarily American public life essentially becomes a television show that is largely being produced and aimed at him and driven by the way that he reacts to him. People in the White House will book themselves onto Fox shows that they know that he watches in order to make arguments to their boss, because, you know, they have found that the mediated image of them on a screen is more persuasive than the actual presence of them in person. I think that, you know, at the same time that I'm writing through Donald Trump's rise about how television is a powerful political influence in, you know, in terms of being a route to power in America, it's also really kind of the story of what it is like to live inside the brain of a TV junkie, which is essentially is what we all do now. You know, even if you don't watch Fox News, even if you don't watch cable news, you're living in a political reality whose metabolism is driven by a president who very much immerses himself in that 24/7 news environment and reacts to it, and sort of thrives on that constant enervation and chaos.
And I'm curious, you know, we've been through, including the campaign, roughly 4 years nonstop of this. What changes, if any, do you see in terms of the way the cable news channels treat him, the way that television in general treats him?
I think that cable news, you know, again, with, you know, Fox is an exception because, you know, Fox is his home base. Essentially, it's his safe place on television. I think television news generally has become a little more conscious of how it was, you know, basically used by the Trump campaign in the 2016 election, in the sense of, you know, Donald Trump was able to receive. People have estimated in the billions of dollars worth of earned media through the constant coverage of his campaign, of his rallies, of his empty podium as he got ready to go on for rallies, because he so instinctively and so well understood the camera's appetite for sensation and controversy. You know, that's kind of the business model of 24-hour cable news. And so he reaped those benefits. I think that, you know, cable news certainly is a little more conscious of that, although it certainly has still benefited since he's been president of, you know, an all Trump all the time news environment. You know, even when the coverage is skeptical of Trump or adversarial, you know, still those, you know, the sense of constant conflict has been good for cable news ratings. So, you know, I think they've learned lessons in certain ways. You know,
James, let me ask you to hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. My guest is James Poniewozik. He is the chief TV critic at the New York Times and author of Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. As we were going to the break, you were in the middle of a thought about how the cable news networks have shifted and adjusted during the Trump presidency versus the Trump campaign. Go ahead.
I would just say, you know, I think that they've, you know, learned some things from 2016, you know, the effects of covering Trump rallies and beginning to end, which was essentially, you know, granting him, you know, an hours long free campaign ad. But the addiction to, you know, sort of the Trump show that still exists because a controversial, you know, flamboyant, media savvy president provides the media, you know, an electronic media, particularly the thing that it craves, which is constant excitement, constant sensation. That's what keeps people tuned in.
So how do you think it will be different, if you think it will be different, with the 2020 campaign? How do you think Trump fits into campaign coverage, and at the same time, how will Democrats try to adjust, knowing what they know from 2016?
Well, the first thing that will be different is it's not just that, you know, Trump is an incumbent, which always has an influence on media coverage of an election. But so much of the story of the 2016 election, and certainly in the media, was the kind of universal belief that it was this amazing, sort of unbelievable, shocking thing that, you know, Donald Trump, the guy from The Apprentice, was running for president. He was never going to win. Right. So, you know, you could have him host Saturday Night Live and, you know, what did it really matter? Because it was kind of this novelty. Right. He's president now. So we've established that Donald Trump can win a presidential election. So I think that aspect of, you know, where in 2016 Hillary Clinton was sort of covered as a potential next president of the United States and Donald Trump was covered as, you know, kind of a political novelty show, that will be gone. His ability to monopolize coverage through, you know, seeking out fights and tweeting and insulting and working up the, you know, raising the pulse of his opponents, that all is still there. And that is a powerful tool often for a politician, because what it does is it makes you the protagonist of the news. It makes the story of the campaign either about you or how other people are responding to you. And as a result, you know, as you say, the Democrats, you know, in their primary, have to figure out, have to sort of advance arguments for how they will deal with that. And there's basically two broad schools of thought. You know, one is you have to, you know, counter-program Trump and provide your own narrative and, you know, find a way to get the attention of the media by, you know, being something new, being sort of a proactive counter to this, you know, 24-hour show that we've been living in, or you offer yourself as sort of a chance to turn the show off, right? You offer yourself as a calming presence, a return to a time when you didn't have to, you know, wake up in the morning and check your phone all the time to see what the president has tweeted. So I think that those are sort of the two broad, you know, kind of media theories of how to counter Trump under the in the Democratic primary. And in a way, I think the Democratic primary right now is kind of a meta argument about how to deal with Trump in this media environment that he's thrived in.
Now, in case we don't have enough to watch and look at on social media for the past month or so, we've had the impeachment hearings and testimony going on in Washington. And I thought it was interesting, in November, you wrote a column in the Times about coverage of Watergate in 1973,
yeah.
And you went back and you watched some of the PBS broadcasts hosted by McNeil Lehrer, and you compared that time with our multimedia, multi-channel, tribal environment here in 2019. And your conclusion, I thought, was really interesting, which is that for people who can remember that era, what they really wish is that it could be 1973 again, that we could have, quote, that shared focus and trust. And I'm wondering whether you think it's naive and foolish to think we'll ever have a consensus of facts again when it comes to our political discourse.
Well, you know, I think it's not very likely, because, you know, that's basically wishing that you could turn back time. A lot of these changes in our political and social culture, you know, and this is something that I'm highly aware of as a TV and media critic, are driven by the dynamics and the structure of our media. And when you have, you know, a television environment where there are, you know, just three major networks that have to appeal to tens of millions of people, you're necessarily going to have a different voice and a different tone and a different environment than when you have a niche media environment where there's, you know, a cable news network for this political sensibility and one for that one. And there are talk radio shows and social media feeds and internet platforms all driven at reinforcing certain points of view. You know, short of, you know, I don't know, an electromagnetic pulse event that wipes out modern media technology and causes us to, you know, start over again from the Gutenberg age. You can't really go back toward that. That doesn't mean to say that, you know, our environment can't change further for other reasons. It doesn't mean that, you know, things are necessarily going to get better or worse. But I do think that it's hard to imagine a way where we go back to that kind of homogeneous monoculture because we don't have a media environment in which that can exist.
There's with all of the impeachment hearings, there has been some griping from people that these are not making for compelling television. I think Politico described it as not must-see TV. And the question would be, should this be must-see TV when we get into a matter as serious as impeachment?
I mean, on the one hand, you know, there's no constitutional requirement for pizzazz, you know, in an impeachment proceeding. I mean, you know, impeachment is one of the most serious things that the Congress can do, and it should be handled seriously, and, you know, the substance of it actually matters. However, I don't think that it's unfair to critique public impeachment hearings as television messaging, because that's what they are. You know, that's why these arguments are being made publicly. You're trying to, you know, engage with people, and you are trying to sort of tell a story and create a narrative that gets, you know, people from point A to the point B that you want them to logically arrive at. So, you know, Democrats bringing impeachment hearings, whether one, you know, feels it's cheapening to say this, they are putting on a television show. And that television show, like any, you know, political campaign, is making an argument. And, you know, it should be judged in part on how well they're doing that. Now, having said that, I don't think that excuses a lot of, you know, what is often very kind of shallow political commentary on it, where, you know, if you don't sort of, you know, if every witness isn't like, you know, Jack Nicholson in A Few Good Men, then you're judging the proceedings boring. You know, I do think that, you know, the pundits analyzing this have an obligation to pay attention to the substance, but substance always goes hand in hand with format, you know, and with style.
Again, that's the voice of James Poniewozik. He is the author of Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. I want to ask you about what is typically a dismal television production, and it's coming right here to Charlotte next summer, which is national political conventions, in this case, the RNC. And for years, people have written this off as nothing more than a television show, and they've also written it off as nothing more than a boring television show. So with that in mind, what do you expect from both the Democrats and the Republicans in terms of the staging, the pacing, the look of a political convention in 2020?
These often depend on the nominees, right? Because the convention is kind of a show that is produced to, you know, kind of highlight and echo the message and the persona of the party's nominee. So, you know, what the DNC is going to look like is probably going to depend in part on who the DNC nominates. But I suspect that, you know, kind of as a television production, you know, one thing that it's probably going to emphasize is, you know, this idea of return to normalcy and, you know, relief from the kind of media chaos of the Trump era. You know, if you go back and remember the 2016 conventions, they were really strikingly different as, you know, just TV productions. Trump's RNC was, you know, much more, you know, there were the lock her up chants. It was a much less polished production. It was a much more sort of reality TV type production, which, you know, it really ended up fitting the, you know, the person who was being nominated there. I am curious whether we see that sort of thing from, you know, the renominating convention of President Trump, who, you know, now has a party united behind him and may, ironically, for that reason, put on a much more boring show than he did in 2016, because, you know, just politically, incumbency is kind of boring media-wise.
Obviously, what we're talking about, the book and a lot of the columns that you write, are blending politics and television and media. And I'm curious, you are a general interest TV critic. So with all of this going on in the Trump era, how do you find time to watch traditional television at this point?
Oh, I don't. I mean, I do, but it's just juggling a lot. You know, the fact of TV nowadays and being a TV critic is, you know, with Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and 500, you know, different cable channels producing original programming, it's much less about trying to cover everything out there, and it's much more about sort of sifting through things and doing triage and trying to find, you know, what's actually interesting and worth saying something about. So, you know, as far as balancing that with you know, the political TV aspect of my job, it's just kind of a matter of going back and forth. And, you know, at sometimes on the calendar, the politics stuff is going to be more significant. And at other times that goes into a lull and there are more interesting things to say on the entertainment side of my job. So, you know, I've kind of done that for a while. But, you know, I also really take the point of view, whether I'm covering Game of Thrones, you know, or writing about a presidential convention, is culture is news, right? In the sense that culture matters to people. They're interested in reading about it and analyzing it because it touches on things that are important to them in the larger world. So, you know, without getting too pretentious about it, in a way, I feel it's all kind of the same job. You know, when I'm covering politics as a TV event, I'm looking for the same sorts of subtext and emotional messaging that I do when I'm, you know, reviewing an HBO drama. And if I'm reviewing something on HBO or Comedy Central, I'm looking for the same sort of ideas and, you know, commentary about the culture that I do when I'm looking at politics. So in a way, you're kind of using the same muscles. It's just it is an awful lot to sift through.
And one of the points you make toward the end of the book is about the importance of story and narrative, obviously, in all cultures, including American politics. And you compare and contrast how Barack Obama constructed his political life story versus Trump. And I wonder, as you're watching the Democratic debates this time with 59 people, give or take, on the stage, who do you see out there that presents an interesting narrative, an interesting story, or has the potential to?
You know, I think that – honestly, I think that a lot of the leading candidates – have interesting approaches to media, but in different ways. You know, Pete Buttigieg, I think, is a very effective and kind of sharp communicator on a debate stage. Elizabeth Warren has kind of advanced this, you know, this notion of she's very conscious of branding and explaining and, you know, sort of branding herself with an I have a plan for that, you know, sort of thing. Joe Biden is not always the sharpest person on a debate stage, having watched all of these. But, you know, in this era, I think to some people that can, you know, kind of come across as in, you know, sort of unrehearsed authenticity that redounds to his benefit. So, you know, I think that there are actually a lot of good communicators on, you know, on the Democratic debate stage. The big question is just, you know, which form of communication provides the best counter to Donald Trump. And you know, if I knew that, you know, I could be the next president. But, you know, it's certainly the $64,000 question.
In our remaining moments, I want to make sure I include what I think might be the most prescient statement of your book, which is, quote, "There will presumably be a Donald J. Trump presidential library, even if it's just a giant TiVo." So I will look for you at the ribbon cutting, right?
I will be holding the remote.
James Poniewozik, thank you so much for joining us. The book is Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Thanks for joining us on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.